The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Quite finished last time with a few points on 1E, visitation as a foundation for justice. I was in the middle of observing that if you take into account the nature of the presence of God or the coming of God as the foundation of justice, then that implies that penalties also will be different in cases relating to the particular presence, the special presence of God in Israel. You could even argue that it is unjust to have the same penalties in those cases because the law of Moses itself demands that everyone to whom much is given, much will be required, and much is given to Israel in terms of the presence of God. In addition to that, I think we should notice that the standing back now and looking at the general theme of the presence of God, the presence of God climaxes at the consummation. That is when His glory and presence fills all things in a final way. Hence, every pre-consummation presence of God is an intrusion of the consummation. I think I did mention that. But in addition, the rest character of the consummation, the finished, as it were, fixed character of the consummation, guarantees, I believe, a continuity to all those earlier intrusions or visitations of God's presence. In other words, you come full circle and say, we expect continuity as well. You know, the visitation ID starts out with emphasizing discontinuity, and lo and behold, you find in the very middle of it the necessity of affirming a continuity because of the fixed character of the consummation as a standard, in a sense, for understanding all pre-consummation visitations of God. So, looking now at the whole of what we've done under Roman numeral 1, we have seen, I hope, that a deep look at the principle of justice, that is, the justice of God, not an abstract principle of justice, a deep look at that shows that it must cover all situations. That is, that it must somehow explain or explicate the discontinuities that are apparent in Scripture. Hence, an appeal to God's justice cannot blindly be used to argue for pure continuity. Now, Bonson, as I mentioned, and some of the other leaders are sophisticated enough to see that, but I think it tends to come out in popularizations and superficial readings of Bonson as a matter of pure continuity. But once you start pushing on the principle of justice, I think you see it must cover anything. To be more specific, if you say in a naive fashion, which I believe Bonson does not, if you say in a naive fashion, the penalties of the Old Testament law must simply be carried over one-to-one, then the question might rightly be asked, which penalties? Those of the Garden of Eden? Those at Mount Sinai? Those at the conquest under Joshua? Those in the temple precincts? I think Bonson's answer tends to be, although he qualifies it with its at least the latest thing I'm hearing, I'm not sure it's there in the theonomy in Christian ethics, is it's the general equity of the law. But at an earlier point, at least, I was hearing from a lot of theonomists every point in the penalties. And if so, which penalties? And the answer is, well, it's the penalties of the law of Moses that were to apply to a continuous situation in the land. And Bonson's book does distinguish, but you see, I'm saying those are not the only penalties. Why pick those out? And once you realize that there are several kinds of penalties, then what governs the selection of one rather than another, you got to take into account the discontinuities there. Bonson's answer to that in his book was, distinguish between positive law and standing law. Positive law is a law given once. Abraham sacrificed Isaac on the place I will show you. That is given only to Abraham, only at one point in his life, and it's not then some kind of general rule that everybody is to follow. That would be absurd. Standing law is law then that is on the books, all right, that is not just issued once by a specific command of God, but it is intended to be obeyed then over a period of time. It's law on the books. Well, that sounds good until you realize that, in fact, that distinction is a relative distinction. The law, for instance, that God issued that any animal that touches the mount must be stoned was standing law as long as the people were at Mount Sinai. That is, it was applicable for the whole period that they were at Mount Sinai. The law about following the pillar of cloud and fire was standing law as long as the people were in the wilderness and were on their way. And the law of the conquest was applicable through the whole conquest period. And the law of Moses that is designed to be serve them while they're in the land is applicable at least as long as they're in the land, but how much longer? You see, the question is relative length of periods. There are very few commands that apply just to one moment of time. There are many commands, the commands with respect to the temple precincts, the commands with respect to the Garden of Eden. All those were standing law governing a certain period of time in a certain geographical area. And the issue in dispute is precisely that, just how much of the Mosaic penal system is standing law only for that geopolitical kingdom, the language that Klein uses, and how much of it then embodies principles that are of universal relevance to all nations and so on. So I really think that issue is in part the issue in dispute there. But also, I'm disturbed in the isolation of the law applying once you've conquered the land, as if we couldn't learn anything about God's justice from the other materials, from the period at Mount Sinai, from the temple precincts. If you really believe, oh, how I love thy law, you believe all of those laws are relevant, not just the ones that apply to the specific situation of living in the land of Canaan, right? So I'd say, look, Theonomist, you haven't gone far enough. Take seriously all the law of the Old Testament, not only material which you pick out as standing law. Now, the point of that is, then, that it forces a person to deal with the matter of discontinuity, which I want to see in there. Now let's start the other way. Start with the visitation idea, which we associate with discontinuity, and see that we can push there. A deep look at the principle of intrusion or the theme of the presence of God shows that it must cover all time because there can be no penalties that are just at all apart from a presence of God. Therefore, you must explain the continuities too. You see, you can't just invoke the idea of the presence of God as if was an explanation that only held for discontinuities. The sanctions of the law are relative to the situation, but of course, all situations are situations in which God is present in one way or another. So the point is that both of these principles, in fact, will lead you into some kind of central area where you realize you've got to deal with continuity and discontinuity. You've got to deal with the whole show. Now, with that as a background, then, I intend to look at some of the specifics because I think we really can't deal with some of the nitty-gritty differences in conclusion between Bonson and Klein without looking at specific laws. So I intend to go on then to Roman numeral 2 to look at some specific laws, but in the light of the context of Deuteronomy in particular. And several points under that. A, what is the justice of God? I believe there is no quick definition that will exhaust it any more than there is a quick definition that will exhaust God himself. Everything that the Bible says is relevant directly or indirectly if you believe what I've argued about the centrality of justice in all God's acts. But more particularly, and this is capital B, let us focus on the question of what is just recompense, because it is there more than any other point that the two camps have their pointed disagreement. The central question, the central issue, is that of penology, recompense for crimes of various kinds. Now, in Deuteronomy, and this is not confined to Deuteronomy, but it is certainly there in Deuteronomy, there is a focus on a principle of people receiving what is due to them, a principle of balancing. What you have done will be done to you. That is formulated in various ways. Genesis 9:6, whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. And note the universal context of this establishing a framework of law after the flood of Noah, so applicable then in principle to all Noah's descendants, in other words, to the whole human race. Obadiah 15, as you have done, it shall be done to you. Your deeds shall return on your own head. Jeremiah 50, verse 29. Habakkuk 2, verse 8. Joel 3, verse 4 and verse 7. Matthew 7, verse 2. In New Testament now, for with the judgment you pronounce, you will be judged. Exodus 21, verse 24. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth. Quoted, of course, in Matthew 5, 38. Now, you see, what we have here is a broad principle that is cropping up here and there through the course of whole of Scripture. There's also, I believe, a sense of eschatological recompense that really fills it out, but I don't want to go into the details of that. Secondly, capital C, there is the question of a reciprocity or balancing here that involves the parties that are injured by a sin or crime of one kind or another, and the parties that receive the punishment and by whom the punishment is issued. Now, that question of by whom, who is authorized, who is even commanded to inflict a punishment and to receive a recompense, those questions cannot rightly be evaded. And in fact, the theonomists themselves have been, I think, commendably sensitive at many points to that very issue of saying the state does not have infinite power, the state is not God walking on earth, the state's power is delegated, it has authority to do certain things, all right? But other people, parents, elders in the church, and so on, have other kinds of authority, and the state cannot usurp whatever authority it wishes, all right? So that question of by whom is quite relevant there. Also the question, if you apply it in a universal level, of God versus man. Certainly, there's where Van Til is emphasizing again and again, we must remember creator-creature distinction, distinguish between the original authority which God has and the derivative authority which human beings have. Now, you see this principle articulated already in the key passage in Genesis 9, verse 6. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. Not simply by God. All right? Now, God has been offended by a crime of murder, but God does not simply reserve punishment for himself, but he assigns the right, the duty even, of the penal sanction on a human being. And you can see the balancing, all right? You have killed, you have shed the blood yourself of another person, and now another person, another human being, is going to shed your blood as a recompense, as a paying back for what you have done. More specifically, you find, as it is worked out later in the Mosaic time, that the person who is to execute the murderer is the avenger of blood. Numbers 35, 19, and the whole surrounding passage, if you want to look it up. We haven't time just now. But the avenger of blood generally was the nearest of kin. All right, so as a very specific person. Now, with respect to the crime of theft, if you look at the statutes in the Mosaic Law, the thief who is caught is to repay what he has stolen. However, he does not repay it to the state. And the theonomists have quite rightly, I think, criticized the modern penal system for theft and saying the state is, again, usurping kind of role that it has no right to. You don't pay yourself back to the state, but you pay to the injured party. And that is, there's a few instances now I think we're seeing in America where people are getting their heads on and realizing that there's something to be said for that kind of situation. Now, if you look at the situation with theft more closely, there are two people who are injured by an act of theft. I'll talk about the diagram in a minute. One person who is injured is God. God is injured or offended by any sin, and any sin is an insult against God. And of course, that will be recompensed at the last judgment and in hell or by the substitution of Christ. It demands recompense and it gets recompense by God himself. But that is not the only person who is offended by an act of theft. It is also, there is an owner, all right? So, person B steals a sheep from person A, who owned it. Now, if you look in the Mosaic Law, you'll find that there's also regulations, before we look at thievery, there's regulations for borrowing. Somebody borrows a sheep from somebody else, and then it gets injured or dies while he's with it. Well, he must replace it. One sheep for one, okay? He must replace the sheep which he was responsible for. But, of course, he didn't want to steal it, all right? He temporarily took it with the owner's permission, but he was going to bring it back, and he didn't succeed, so he does the best he can. He replaces it with another sheep. Okay, and that levels things out again. Things are balanced once again when the borrower has restored the sheep, either the original sheep or, if the sheep dies, restores a substitute sheep. Now, the thief, what's the difference between a borrower and a thief? The thief intended to keep the thing in his own possession. All right? So, when you find the thief, what you do is you force him to give back the one that he had stolen, right? Now, that one giving back simply restores the thing to the balance that it originally had. But because he intended to deprive the owner of a sheep, you make him give another one. Two sheep. Okay? And this gets complicated. If he sold the sheep or has already killed it and eaten it or something, then he must pay back four sheep. Now, it's not entirely clear why there, but it seems to me there's an additional doubling, all right? Because once he's sold the thing, he's unable to really restore the situation, so he gets double the double. And there's five ox for an oxen, and I don't understand that, except if it's a little more than four. Jim Jordan has tried to speculate as to why that is. But I think the basic principle we see in that is that doubling, all right? You intended to take it away permanently. You not only restore what you did, but you restore it again. You are permanently deprived of the sheep instead of the owner being deprived because that's what you intended to do for him, you see. Now, if you go through different kinds of crimes, you will find that kind of balancing, particularly with respect to thievery, where things can be restored. Or if they're sold even, the substitute can be restored, replace it with another sheep. What do you do in the case of murder? Well, if you follow this analogy, which I'm arguing is a general principle of this balancing, as you have done, it shall be done to you. In the case of murder, what you ought to do is to bring the dead person back to life that would restore the thing to the original situation. And then for your life, if you're the murderer, for your life to be taken, because you intended to take the life of the other person, right? But of course you can't do that because you have not the power to bring the dead person back to life. And so you do the best you can, which is pretty horrible. Namely, you just take the life of the murderer. Now, that is already, I think, a proclamation of the insufficiency of justice within the bounds of this life, that we can't do everything that strict justice demands. Now, God will, you see. There is a resurrection. There is the recompense for everything, but it doesn't come immediately. You can't do everything. There's some things you don't have power to do, and so you do the best you can. And I think people's revulsion against capital punishment nowadays is partly due to just a sheer humanism where they don't believe in God, and so this life is all they have, and they can't contemplate ending it for anybody. But I think there's also maybe a little intuition that taking the murderer's life is really not the solution, because you don't bring the dead man back to life, you see. And I think they're right, although I still think God is wise in saying, look, within this life, these are the limited powers and obligations which you have. Now we come to, now I could go into other things, but let me work it out, all right, in terms of thievery, what I've just said. All right, the thief has taken a sheep. So then you make him pay back one sheep, and the situation is back where it was. And then you do it in reverse, because he intended to permanently deprive the owner, so you permanently deprive, or the authorities permanently deprive him of his sheep, and it goes back to the owner, who then gains a sheep. And as I say, if the sheep has been sold in the meantime, then it's double again. Now I want you to ask something else. D, that concerns the special character of insults to God's presence in community, or some people have called this sacral crimes. Every sin is a crime against God. Now, that's one of the things that muddies the waters, in a sense. I mean, it's true enough, but it muddies the waters to bring it in. Why? Because, as I see it, the theonomists and I agree, not every sin does the state have a right to punish. The state can't punish sins of the mind, for instance, where there is no clear-cut evidence. But presumably other kinds of things too, like gossip, are not punishable, even though they are clear-cut sins. The state is just not given authority to act in that area. Although slander then would be getting over into an area where the state has some powers. So the real question is, what are those issues where there is the right of human beings to act? Now, God is going to punish all sins. That's what the last judgment is about, and that's what preliminary judgments within history, judgments on whole cities like Nineveh, that's what that's about. God has the right to punish, and he will punish. But in the meantime, short of that last judgment, what are human beings supposed to do, particularly authorities of the state? They don't have universal authority. They're not to take the reins of God in their own hands. Well, as I see it, over and over again in the Old Testament, it is to straighten out things where there has been damage to another human being. Thievery is both a crime against God, which he will punish, but it is also injury to another human being, which then there is authorities have a duty to step in and straighten out, to rebalance that thing, to give recompense that restores a situation in line with the principles of justice. Now ask yourself concerning a certain number of crimes and penalties that are there in the Old Testament that involve, apparently, insults to God. Blasphemy, false worship, inciting to false worship, Sabbath breaking. Those are sins against God, but so is everything else. What distinguishes those things that they should have the penalties, not merely penalty in hell or by the substitution of Christ on the cross, what distinguishes those things that they also involve penalties which other human beings are involved in inflicting? Answer, I believe, is the same thing. That it's not merely God who has been offended, it is also, in this case, the community of God's people who bear the name of God and who have been profaned by an act of idolatry or similar offense within their midst. Look at Deuteronomy 13, and I believe you'll see this operating. If a prophet, one who foretells by dreams, appears among you and announces to you a miraculous sign or wonder, he goes, says, let's go follow other gods, all right, let's worship them. You must not listen to the words of that prophet or dreamer. The Lord your God is testing you to find out whether you love him with all your heart and with all your soul. So it is apparently focused on community who already belong to God. It is the Lord your God you must follow, and him you must revere. And then it goes on. Now, the most interesting part is about what if a whole town goes astray. In verse 12, if you hear it said about one of the towns the Lord your God is giving you to live in, holy land as I see it, that wicked men have arisen among you and have led the people of their town astray, saying, let us go and worship other gods, gods you have not known, then you must inquire, probe, and investigate it thoroughly. And if it is true, and it has been proved that this detestable thing has been done among you, you must certainly put to the sword all who live in that town, destroy it completely, both its people and its livestock, gather all the plunder of the town into the middle of the public square, and completely burn the town and all its plunder as a whole burnt offering to the Lord your God. It is to remain a ruin forever, never to be rebuilt. None of these condemned things shall be found in your hands, so that the Lord will turn from his fierce anger. He will show you mercy. You see, they are threatened with judgment from the Lord if they tolerate this profanation in their midst. What has happened is a town that was part of the towns in the Holy Land and among the holy people has gone astray and has thereby profaned both the people in whose midst they were and the land which was sacred to the Lord. What do you do? There's been a crime against God, but there's also been a crime against the people in whose midst they were. Now, apply the principle. God must pay recompense, and of course he will, in hell and sometimes in judgments in history. But there must also be an action on the part of the people who have been profaned. What are they to do? They are to offer the town up as a whole burnt offering. In other words, they are, as a company of priests, to execute the recompense on the town. And two things happen, as I see it. The offending town has profaned the whole land and the whole of the rest of the people. The rest of the people profane the town. But, of course, it's already profane. How do you do it? You double the profanation by complete destruction. But you also have to say how... If the one party has been profaned, how are they cleansed? How are they set back right? The answer is through a whole burnt offering, which purifies. In other words, everything gets balanced out here by an action, note, of the holy community. So my argument would be, ask who is doing, who is executing the penalty here. And the answer is, it's not just a state in some general sense. It is the community who have been profaned who are executing the judgment. And that is what justice means, all right? That it involves that deep balancing and reciprocity in the presence of God. There's one other element here, and that is in the final verse, our semifinal verse, verse 17, none of those condemned things. The word, some of you will recognize, harem, is describing what is devoted for destruction. It's the same word, and I'm not arguing simply from verbal parallels, but this is a bit of a loaded term. It's the same word used in connection with a conquest under Joshua. What you're dealing with, in effect, is a holy war against this city, which has become virtually a pagan city. And it becomes condemned, it becomes devoted to destruction in the same way that the Canaanite cities were when the people of Israel entered to conquer the land. Similarly, even with respect to adultery, it's a little hard for me to be sure that I've understood that completely. The death penalty is invoked for adultery. What is adultery damage? Well, it damages the marriage, the family structure, right? But the people who execute the judgment are the men of the city. Evidently, it is also seen as an attack on vows that have been made socially and the family structure, which is integral to the very existence of the community itself. So the community itself is, in effect, threatened with destruction, and in turn, the person receives the death penalty for that. But I'm not sure how much that's related to the particular familial structure of the people of God versus general state structure. Would the principle of balancing suggest, if you have profaned the sexuality of the marriage, that your own sexuality be profaned, say, with castration? So that there's other possibilities that if indeed this penology is related to the holy community, there's other possibilities of what might be fitting apart from the holy community. I'm not sure. But I think it has to be thought about. In other words, that we penetrate through, and what I've been hearing lately from Bonson is that he wants to do it, so it's unclear how he would react to what I'm saying. Penetrate through to the general principles of equity, and Bonson has used that term, general equity of the thing, not simply blindly take over individual penalties. Now, I've got something more to say about this, and that comes under, well, eschatology. What I want to say is there that there are various elements in Old Testament penology which point to the insufficiency of the situation. I've mentioned the rather indirect argument about the punishment for murder, but in the case of manslaughter, which is accidental, all right, you, by accident, somebody is killed, well, you'd like to bring that person back to life, but you can't do it. What happens to the man, the one person who's guilty of manslaughter? He frees the city of refuge until the death of the high priest. It looks like, although it's a little mysterious, it looks like there is not only a penalty attached, serious penalty in terms of the restriction of where that person can go, but also why the death of the high priest? You see, there is symbolic overtones there that the death of the high priest represents a substitutionary kind of thing which frees the person. See, so there's the hope of the resurrection that is held out somehow in that kind of situation. The whole burnt offering is an anticipation of the offering to destruction in the fires of hell. So there's an eschatological forward-looking dimension to this, that not everything is perfectly dealt with and can't be until the coming of the final presence of God. F, there is also the question, a very tangled question, which I don't want to get into in detail, of the relationship of the juridical and the cultic in Old Testament Israel in our time. What is it that the people of Israel do in a way that is like the modern state, the juridical sphere, and what is it that is like the people of God associated with the cultic sphere? But things get confused because the elders of the church have juridical authority. So it would seem that the parallel between the elders of the church and the elders in Israel. And I think that's going to be an important point, which I'll come back to later when we discuss what is the by whom question, who is to execute the penalty, and that also throws light eventually on what kind of a penalty is fitting in our time. Is it the same or different? I want to go on quickly then to the establishment of justice in the book of Deuteronomy, capital G. And to emphasize, first of all, the quest, what I'm after in this whole section is the mode of establishing the law, a particular set of laws, over a geographical area. Now, in a sense, you can say, well, God's law is what it is and is valid for the whole earth. But what I'm dealing with is Israel was not permitted to come into the land of Canaan just in any way that they pleased. There were definite instructions, and those instructions embody a justice of God. There is a just and an unjust way of conquering the world for Christ, if to put it in modern terms. The question is, what are the standards for the way in which we bring in justice? In a sense, the issue between Klein and Bahnsen boils down to this question, believe it or not. There are these sanctions, these penalties for blasphemy, for inciting to false worship, the things we've looked at. And those penalties are to be executed over all the earth. Both Klein and Bahnsen agree to that. The question is, when and how? At the consummation, Klein says. Or, right now, which is not what Bahnsen says, or gradually as we get into a more post-millennial situation. I haven't mentioned it yet, I should have, but there is a connection between post-millennialism and theonomy. Not a tight connection, and Bahnsen has been quick to stress that. But some of the reckoning, some of the laws of theonomy come into their own only in a post-millennial situation where the population has more or less become Christian. I mean, not every individual, but predominantly. In that situation, they say, it's appropriate to bring in these laws against blasphemy and so on. And many of them would not say that it's appropriate simply in, say, Burma of today to do that. They'd say it's impractical, of course, but the question is it legitimate if you could do it? So the question in some sense is how and when are these sanctions relevant rather than are they relevant? The principle I want to formulate is that the mode of establishment of justice over a particular geographical area is the same as the mode of its maintenance in a fundamental respect. Now, there's obviously going to be differences, but I want to appeal to the very continuity principle that is the theonomists are interested in. And in the Mosaic period, if you look at the mode of the establishment of justice, it is harem warfare, that is, it is the holy war of the conquest under Joshua, led by the servant of the Lord, by Joshua, who is especially commissioned to do so, and, of course, by the commander of the armies of the Lord, whom Joshua meets in Joshua 5, the divine servant of the Lord. And that warfare is also according to the law of the Lord as specified in Deuteronomy, among other things. That is, it has definite standards. You can't do what you want. You go in and do it according to God's own principles. The maintenance of justice proceeds along the same lines as I think I've already illustrated from Deuteronomy 13. Namely, that when a town falls into paganism, such as characterized the Canaanites in the land, you are to renew a holy war against that town, and you do with that town the same thing as you did in conquering the land. Now, if you go to the book of Joshua and to Deuteronomy 20 as well, you find out that the heads of the army and the priests have a role of leadership. Now, there's ways of interpreting that as applicable for our time, but what I want to get into is, in fact, you can see that is very much involved with the structure of holy war of Deuteronomy 23, for instance, verse 9. We haven't got time to look at that. Now, if you ask, how was justice established over Israel itself? Is Israel immune from the same process that was executed over the land of Canaan? The answer, I believe, is similar, that the coming of God and the presence of God, you see, God was marching into Israel with the people, and the Ark of the Covenant symbolized his presence. And to come there was also then, that was the fitting time. There were other reasons too, because the iniquity of the Canaanites had become full, but it was a fitting time for then the execution of sanctions. But how did God come to be present in Israel itself? And Israel not die for the same reason that the Canaanites would die. The establishment of God's reign of justice over the land comes by consecration to death. That's what happened to those towns of Canaan. The establishment over Israel comes by consecration to death, namely, the death of the firstborn. Exodus from Egypt, right? The death of the firstborn, except substituted for by a lamb. And if you want to go back further than that, how did the calling of the people of Israel come about itself? By the death of Isaac as the firstborn, substituted for by a ram. In other words, there has to be a death. If it's not the death of the person involved, it's the death of a substitute, which still preserves that reciprocity, that preserves that balance. And there's also a figurative death in the waters of the Red Sea, because the waters, ancient Near East, symbolize the going down into the underworld and the waters of chaos and of death. So all this points forward to a more efficacious sacrifice. That is, that there is a final whole burnt offering offered up by Christ himself in his crucifixion that has power to cleanse his people, even as they were never cleansed, or cleansed, you might say, only in a symbolic level by those sacrifices and animal sacrifices that were substitutes in the Old Testament. Now that, I would claim, is the structure of harem warfare. That's what harem warfare is about. In other words, it is the warfare of a whole burnt offering that's consecration to death. It is the way in which the land is cleansed and the way in which the presence of God and the justice of God and the rule of God are established over a geographical area. Now, when some people have heard that much, they might think the argument is over. Because the clear parallel with this kind of thing going on in the Old Testament is with Ephesians 6. There's spiritual warfare that Paul describes at the end of Ephesians 6 from verse 10 onwards, for which we must put on the whole armor of God. And that warfare is holy war. That is consecration to death. It is death to the supernatural authorities and powers of wickedness. So we are then fulfillers of that law and those penal sanctions of the Mosaic law in just the way that Paul describes in Ephesians 6. In other words, it's all applicable, it's all being fulfilled. It's just a question of what it really means. You know, is that what it really means, you see, rather than something that the state is to do with blasphemy? So you might think that's, okay, the argument is all over. It isn't over, friends. It's just begun. The reason is that Bonson, in his book, points out that typology doesn't necessarily exhaust the fulfillment. Any kind of typological connections and meanings that you may find do not by themselves undermine the possibility that there is also a straight line application of the principle to the modern state. For instance, there is a concern on Bonson's part to preserve the penalty for murder and to say if the state, does the state still have the power of the sword? Evidently it does from Romans 13 and other passages. Is it still then obligated to deal with crimes of murder? And if so, how? And what is to be the penalty? And well, Klein and Bonson would agree at that point that the penalty is to be capital punishment, because they're dealing with a statute going back to Genesis 9:6 of the Noahic period, which Klein then does associate with universal principles that apply to the modern state. So far, so good. But what about other crimes and other penalties? And what about my question about mixing different kinds of seed? Is it clear that that's been abrogated? Is that clear that that is fulfilled in some typological way by our separation from what is unclean? Even if it is, does it rule out a separate fulfillment in the area of agriculture? So I think the Bonson's appeal is technically correct, namely that typology doesn't eliminate the possibility of a straight line fulfillment. But I think it makes it almost impossible to prove the contrary, in the sense of you can always argue that there's still a straight line fulfillment. Now, I think in reply to this then, well, there are several elements, and that is that we have, as I've said before, the debate is not simply on whether the Old Testament law is applicable to us, but understanding it, all right? And there's where I think typology can be written off a little too quickly, as if this were some, tangential, insignificant element when we come down to interpreting the meaning of the Old Testament. Whereas I would argue, if you believe that the whole of Scripture is Christocentric, as Gaff and I have argued, then that is integral to the meaning. So it's a little more difficult to separate out and say, okay, you may in addition, or even as the main thing, have a straight line continuation. But I still don't think that settles the question, because you can debate it back and forth at that point. You can't eliminate the possibility. So I think what we need is a careful assessment of this unique structure of the penalties in the case of inciting to false worship and blasphemy and so on, particularly as it involves the question of who is executing the penalty. The dispute is not over whether every jot and tittle of the law shall be fulfilled, because both sides think that there is fulfillment, and that fulfillment extends to the jot and tittle. The question is over interpretation. The question is over the meaning of that very law. And I think what scared me about theonomy in the early days was precisely because they didn't consider that what I hoped to have shown was the significance of the harem warfare and the penalty for inciting to false worship and false prophecy. That in the early days, they didn't even consider that that was a possibility, that it might have that kind of structure. But it was more or less simply a straight statute that you took over. And that scared me. I think things are, at least among some of the leaders I'm seeing, maybe it was there from the beginning, I just didn't know it, but I'm hearing at least more in that area. So I think we've still got some work cut out for us in terms of assessing what is our situation and what type of fulfillment do we get in the New Testament. So for that purpose, I propose to go on to examine the theology of justice in the Gospel of Matthew. And we can at least begin with that today, and we'll conclude, God willing, tomorrow. Capital A, then, is our fundamental passage in Matthew 5:17, which in Bonson's book was a kind of stronghold pro-theonomy passage, and that's one reason why I want to take it up. Matthew 5:17, "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. I tell you the truth, until heaven and earth disappear, not the smallest letter, not the least stroke of a pen will by any means disappear from the law until everything is accomplished. Anyone who breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever practices and teaches these commands will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven. Now, this passage is used, I think, for fairly obvious reasons, because it stresses the abiding relevance and applicability of the Old Testament law. But the question will remain, in what sense? And here I would suggest, then, coloring our understanding of these verses somewhat differently than Bahnsen did, although it was partly for rhetorical purposes. I'm sure that he stressed this passage so strongly in his book. So, several points. First of all, that looking at the context of the Gospel of Matthew, there is, in fact, a program of conquest that is promulgated, that is, a conquest in the name of the Lord that is issued from a new Mount Sinai. This is the Sermon on the Mount, and against the background of the Gospel of Matthew, I don't think it's an accident that Matthew mentions it is on the Mount. See how it goes. From the first of the book of Matthew, Jesus undergoes experiences which are reminiscent of and even are said to fulfill experiences of Moses and of Israel in the Mosaic period. Jesus is threatened with slaughter along with all the other baby children of Bethlehem by Herod, as Moses was threatened by Pharaoh. And then Jesus goes down into Egypt, and he comes out of Egypt. Matthew quotes, "Out of Egypt have I called my son," in the Old Testament context, referring to the deliverance of Israel from Egypt. So then he comes out of Egypt, and as he is then a grown man, he goes into the wilderness to be tested. And he answers the tests in the wilderness by quoting from the book of Deuteronomy, which is the book reflecting on Israel's testing in the wilderness. But whereas Israel was unfaithful, Christ is faithful. And after he's been in the wilderness, then he calls and chooses 12 disciples, standing for the 12 tribes of Israel. He is then forming the nucleus of a new people of God. Well, you're going through Matthew, and with Matthew's strong emphasis on these things took place that this might be fulfilled, it's hard to deny that there is going on a global sense that Matthew is drawing a global picture of fulfillment against the background of which the Sermon on the Mount is to be understood. And then when Jesus stands on the Mount, the new Mount Sinai, if you will, to issue his decrees, they come in the form of blessings rather than cursings of Mount Sinai. And he speaks of a promised land, the meek shall inherit the earth. And he speaks of a theocratic community. You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world, in Matthew 5, 13 to 16. With a universal call to membership in the community, verse 16. In the same way, let your light shine before men universally, that they may see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven. Now, in that context, Jesus says, I've not come to destroy, but to fulfill. And you could understand, I think, how people might well be asking themselves, are you starting all over again? Are you just ignoring the past? Has it got to be done all over again? The answer is no. This is not a destruction, a leaving behind of the past, but it is bringing it to its proper conclusion. Well, our time is up, and we'll talk more about these particular verses next time.